is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. You're listening to Writer's Voices at Crew 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. With me today, I have a fabulous guest. Cheryl Byers Moranville is an award-winning, versatile author of fiction for all ages. She holds a Ph.D. in English literature and has taught as an adjunct professor at various colleges and universities. And I know, Cheryl, you have a class coming up this summer that I want to be sure you tell us about.
Well, I do. I'm going to be teaching at the University of Iowa Summer Writing Festival from June 17th to 23rd.
Yeah, it looks
it's a course called Five Finger Exercise for Novels and Short Stories. It's what it sounds like. It's an opportunity for writers to isolate certain very important fundamental writing skills. So I'm really looking forward to it.
And anybody who takes that class, I think, would be really glad that they did. And let me remind listeners of some more of your credentials in writing. During the last 10 years, Cheryl has written and published 5 books. Her first book, Over the River, is a novel for young readers about a girl's relationship with her father and other family members in the aftermath of World War II. Despite being a first novel, Over the River won many awards, including being named a book list top 10 historical juvenile novel. Cheryl's other books are The Purple Ribbon, a family lap book, The Snows, a four-generation family saga for teens and adults, and A Higher Geometry, a love story for teens about a mathematically gifted girl growing up in the 1960s, which I'm suspecting is kind of autobiographical.
Sort of.
A Higher Geometry also was an award winner. It was named a Bank Street College of Education Best Book and a Book List Top 10 Youth Romance. Today, Cheryl's here to discuss The Hop, her newest book published in March 2012 by Disney Hyperion. The Hop, a novel for young readers about knowing what's important and fighting for it, is a green book, a good book for Earth Day, about toads in gardens and ponds and kids. So welcome, Cheryl.
I'm so glad to be here, Cheryl. I've heard many of your interviews on Writer's Voices, and I know we're going to have fun.
I thought we might start by talking about writing about your passion, because knowing that this book is about toads and gardens and ponds and kids, I think a lot of those things are your passions, and I'm sort of wondering, what was the impetus for writing this book? What was the seed form?
Well, the actual impetus didn't have the slightest thing to do with my passions, but I'm nonetheless grateful for that impetus, and that is an editor who always sort of pushed me to expand my reach, suggested I try a magical realism project. And I had not only never done anything like that, I never thought about doing anything like that, but I started working on it, and I came up with some ideas. And the way it always happens with me, I do infuse my projects with my passions. All of my projects are infused with things that I care deeply about or am troubled by or worried about. And I think two specific events sort of launched me on the hop. One was my granddaughter, Lizzie, who at the time was 9, and she was spending the night, and early the next morning, she's always been a child who loves to watch the sunrise, so early the next morning, we were out on the deck, and she discovered this tiny little tree frog, and we photographed it, and in fact, the picture of that is on my website. It was just such a nice moment, and I live in an area where there has been enormous mall sprawl in the last 10 years. And while my garden and my pond have not literally been threatened, generally very close to us, land has been developed commercially. So, you know, we can't see the stars at night anymore, for example.
That's a big change.
There's no such thing as silence anymore. And that hurt. So that was an impetus.
Well, that's all very interesting. There's so many things I could latch on to ask you about. But first, I want to go back to the magical realism aspect of it. When I hear terms like that, I think of like adult literature, like Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And I would not have classified your book as magical realism, but after you said that, that makes perfect sense. You know, you have a seer, two seers among the characters, and you have praying mantises who have some kind of magical ability to point your main character in the right, main characters, no, just Tad, in the direction of his quest. So that's interesting. Were you consciously thinking about elements of magical realism when you were writing it?
I really wasn't. Again, and I think this is probably true of most writers, we get to a point with our kind of story concept that we realize there's no turning back. We're just going to tell the story. And the sort of form and elements and symbols and, you know, all that stuff, they either happen or they don't. But you can't really, I can't really direct them and make them happen. They have to come organically.
Well, it seems like it really worked fabulously well in this book. So right now we're talking about The Hop. And what age level would you say this is for?
Well, I think the information in the front of the book says ages 8 to 12. And I've done some school visits, and I had a school here in Des Moines actually sort of field test it. I think 12-year-olds, many of them, may be aged out of it a bit, but 8 to 11 is solid.
I think that it's masterful because it works on so many different levels. Like, on one level, this is a lighthearted retelling of The Frog Prince, but it's a much more complicated story than that. And it's, on other levels, it's a very, very spiritual book, and it's a very philosophical book about the cycles of life. And I'm wondering how that came about, like how that much complexity got woven into your story. Did you spend a lot of time kind of noodling over different plot elements?
No, Cheryl, I really didn't. It goes back to what I was saying earlier about no matter what I do, who I am and what I care about and what I worry about just comes out. And I would characterize myself, I guess, as a spiritual person in the sense that I view much of the physical world as a pleasure in its own right, but also as a pointer and suggester of a spiritual world. And so that was almost certainly going to come out. And any time I'm gardening or working in the yard, that's kind of a zen process, you know. So the spirituality just comes inevitably, not by design and intent.
Well, I particularly liked, so the main characters are Tad, who is a toad, and Taylor, who is a young girl. And I particularly liked when Tad is at his first night celebration and the seer of his community recites a prayer. And I think it goes, remember things we have eaten, remember things that have eaten us, remember those who have been eaten, and remember those who may be covered, which covered was this idea of cemented over by development. But I was very charmed by that. So I liked that there was that spiritual level. And also there's like this sort of gritty, you're presenting the cycle of life as it really exists. You're not like pretending there's no such thing as death or failure. And an example of like one of the, you know, a gritty for a kid. I mean, slightly gritty is, I like this passage. But the crow had its eye on something else. It plucked up a small, writhing snake from the grass and settled on a fence, tossing back its head until the last thread of the snake's tail disappeared. I just love that. I felt that was lyrical. I felt like a lot of the language in the book was lyrical, and it also is painting a true life picture, and I suspect that that's the kind of thing that you have seen when you've been working in the garden with your granddaughter, Lucy.
Yes, it is. And, you know, from a sort of human point of view, I don't like to see creatures get eaten because I wouldn't want to be eaten. That's not, you know, my place in the food chain is different. Nothing eats me. But for people who are not at the top of the food chain, that is just the cycle of life.
Interesting. And you do explain to readers in a passage about, you know, like a creature who's eaten itself eventually dies and enriches the soil from which other things grow. So, you know, you're very close to that kind of visceral experience of the earth and the creatures on it.
Yeah, and the toads are so much a part of the earth and such a marker of how we're treating our earth.
How did you feel about writing this in multiple viewpoints? Is that something that you have done a lot of in your other books?
I've not done a lot of it. You know, frankly, I've tried it in my other books. There are a lot of hazards in writing multiple viewpoints. One of them is simply that you're diluting the reader's focus. So it's nothing I would ever presume to do lightly. Now, in The Snows, because that is four generations of family sagas, you know, I felt I had to have different narrators, and I think it worked. But generally, I think it's better to rise to the occasion and limitations of using a single narrator. I think it makes my writing stronger. But here, again, with a girl and a toad as my two main characters, I couldn't figure out any other way to tell the story. And one reason it bothered me, in addition to generally diluting the focus for the reader, is a lot of children in fourth and fifth grade have not yet encountered alternating narrators. You know, that's just not done that much at that lower reading level. So I do think it might be a bit challenging for some readers.
It does seem like it works very well because most of the changes in viewpoint are kind of encapsulated in the different chapters, so you alternate a chapter from the toad's point of view with a chapter from the young girl's point of view.
Yeah, and you know, originally in my first draft, I had some... I used Seer as a narrator in some passages, but those ended up in the revision process getting rewritten.
Now, I did notice a passage or two where it's still from Seer's viewpoint, but it was so short.
Ah, some snuck through there,
yeah,
didn't they?
I think it worked, though. Maybe later on I'll find where that is and share it with you, but I thought it worked fine, and it seems like the response you're getting from fans is pretty positive from just, you know, scrolling around on the internet.
And yes, you know, really, no one has complained about the alternating viewpoint, so
well, there's
it's going to be all right.
There's such rich language in all, like, of course, the viewpoints, the two characters have different voices, but you have rich language throughout all of it, and one of the other passages I particularly liked was when you're talking about what the toads are eating during a celebration.
Yes.
And one of Tad's favorite things is night smacky goo,
uh-huh,
which is slug inside stuffed back in the slug skin.
Well, didn't you want a recipe for making night smacky goo?
Well, I kind of wanted a recipe for making up words like that. I thought that was really a fun phrase. So... did you, like, was that part of the process of this?
That was one of the most enjoyable parts of the project, was getting to make a toad language, you know, and it was more complicated than you might think, but it was great fun to come up with words like night smacky goo, or, you know, their expressions like thank the green grass or moonbeams.
Did your grandchildren help at all in that process of coming up with things?
Oh, boy. I don't think so, truthfully. Once I get going with the project, I'm pretty private about it.
Well, since you brought that point up, tell us a little bit about your first readers.
Well, my first reader on this project was a great blessing to me. This is, I have a wonderful local critique group, but even before they saw it, I had a first reader who was a great blessing. Her name is Carol Gorman, and she lives in Cedar Rapids and is a very well-known children's author in her own right. I started this book when my husband and I were wintering by the seashore, and every other Saturday, I would send Carol a supply of pages, and then in 2 weeks on Saturday, we would talk on the phone. Carol has always been very encouraging to me about my writing. She was my first writing mentor, and she loved the story so. And while it's changed a lot since then, as it went through critique groups and editors and so on, she was the first person who just said, "Oh, I love that story." And of course, that means so much to a writer.
Absolutely, especially coming from someone like Carol Gorman, who's so accomplished.
Exactly. And so I think she's acknowledged as a wonderful first reader. So she was the first reader. And then my critique group here, which is Eileen Boggess, Rebecca Yanni, and Jan Blazin, were my next first readers, and they too were encouraging. You know, people always have good suggestions for revision, and I always take those suggestions very, very seriously. And then after that, it went off to my agent, and then just through the normal channels. But, you know, writers can't, they can't see their own work all that well. And so first readers are vital.
I want to remind listeners, you're listening to Writers' Voices at KRUU 100.1 FM. This is Cheryl Fusco-Johnson. With me today, I have a fabulous guest. It's Cheryl Byers-Moranville, and we're talking about her newest book, The Hop, which came out in March 2012. So another thing that really intrigued me about this book, Cheryl, is the plotting. I thought the plotting was so intricate, and the book was so fast-paced and fun while still being very spiritual that I wondered, you know, I recall that your first book, which was an award-winning book, you often felt did not have a strong plot. I mean, I just remember having discussions with you in the past, and I'm curious about how the plotting of this latest book came about.
Well, and I will say, I don't consider myself a good plotter. I know good plotters, and I know that is not my relative strength. I think I was a better plotter here because at that first editor's suggestion that I have a go at magical realism, I was flung out of my usual element, which is basically historical fiction, historical realistic fiction. And I was just thrust into another zone and had to scramble for those plotting tools and was lucky enough to find them. But I will also say that my editor at Disney Hyperion, whose name is Abby Ranger, when she first took on the project, the book was not as well plotted as it is now.
And so did she give you precise directions for plotting, or what were some of these tools that you availed yourself of?
She did not give me precise directions, except in one instance. Do you remember in the scene where Tad is trying to get from the park where Taylor has taken him, thinking she's doing him a favor? He's trying to get back to the hotel to find and kiss the Queen of the Hop.
I do remember that very well.
Well, there she gave me specific direction because I was really struggling with how to get that done. And she finally threw up her hands and said, "Oh, just do it this way."
So, now, is this when he's manages to get onto a stroller?
Right. He's hopping along, and then he gets kicked, and he lands on on his stroller.
Sort of like that.
Just happens to be going his way. But otherwise, Abby Ranger's direction was more to point out to me where, in her opinion, the plot was not as strong as it needed to be.
That seems,
then I found my own way.
That seems probably the way most editors work, is not actually providing, you know, specific, like, essentially writing the book themselves, but giving the authors ideas of where there might be a weakness that needs to be strengthened, and then the author goes off and tries to figure out how to make it stronger there.
Exactly. You know, every editor I've ever worked with has been a good editor and has done it just that way.
And so what sort of, did you read books about plotting, or did you study some novels, some fantasy books for kids for plotting points?
Yes, I did. There are a couple of books that were just wonderful examples for me. You know, I don't know I could be specific about how they helped me with plot. But one is by Elise Broach called Masterpiece. I think that's the name of it. And of all things, it's about a beetle who paints. And he has a particular gift for painting old masters. Well, you know, that's sort of like a toad that can play rock and roll music, you know. And then the other book I studied for plotting is called something like Emma and the Shrinking Rat or something like that. But the same thing, where there was a real human person engaged with a creature of some kind.
How did you stumble on those two books? Was it just from reading widely, or did people who knew the sort of project you were working on suggest them?
Well, one was just from reading widely, the one about the rat. Elise Broach's book for sort of complicated details complicated reasons I won't try to explain. I had actually seen her manuscript before it was published, and was quite charmed by it. So I just remembered it.
So how much time do you spend writing versus reading? I do remember reading somewhere online that you have read fiction every day of your life ever since you were like 6 or something like that.
Well, maybe 8, but
8.
Yes, I don't think I could go to sleep at night without reading fiction. It is a sad fact, though, that these days the only time I read fiction, my beloved fiction, is when I'm eating lunch. And in the evening, after dinner, before bedtime. So I don't read nearly as much as I used to.
Is that because you're busier writing, or are you out gardening because the weather's nice?
No, it's just because life is busier. But, you know, writing, I try to write 18 hours a week, week after week after week, and that does take a chunk.
Well, it's like having a part-time job.
Exactly.
So tell us about the 10,000 hour rule. I think probably many people have heard it, but some may not have.
Well, it's a concept. I encountered it in Malcolm Gladwell's The Outliers. And it's just the idea that everybody needs about 10,000 hours of practice performance to really come into their own, whether they're a soccer player, a pianist, a surgeon, a plumber, a writer, that it just takes that long to learn your craft and hone your craft and sort of level out at sort of performance capacity.
Do you feel that with writing, the 10,000 hours, like, you're writing in a lot of different genres, so do you think writing anything counts towards your 10,000 hours?
That's an interesting question. I've never really written anything but fiction. I've written a few writing craft pieces, but I don't know, Cheryl.
Yeah, we'll have to ponder that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some skills in writing that are, you know, general to everything. Having a big vocabulary helps. Not that you want to use big words, but you want to use the precise word that you need at the time. So,
exactly.
And then mastering the art of punctuating correctly, you know, that's useful.
So, and just developing the discipline of putting yourself in the chair and doing it.
Yeah, so what's your daily schedule like of writing? If you're doing these 18 hours a week, are you fitting it in different times, or do you have a particular time you try to be at your desk?
Well, first of all, I prioritize it. And so I get up in the morning, brush my teeth, make my coffee, and sit down at my desk. So I basically write from 6:30 to 9:30.
Oh, that sounds nice.
It is. And then the rest of the world starts to wake up and get going. You know, there's usually not much going on before 9:30.
So I want to remind listeners, you're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. I am Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and on Writers' Voices today, our guest is Cheryl Byers-Moranville. We're discussing her delightful book for young people called The Hop. It's a great environmental tale. It's also a very spiritual tale and very colorful. So I'm wondering if you have, I found a little excerpt that you'd like to share with us today.
Well, if you're up for it, I would like to read you just a few of the opening pages.
Great.
Okay. Let me find my page here. Here we go. And I will say that while the chapters alternate between Tad and Taylor, the first one belongs to Tad. Chapter 1. The lonely tunnel had fallen around Tad during the long night of winter and padded him like a brown blanket. But now the earth was stirring, and even 3 feet down, the young hopper felt it. Maybe it was the footsteps of people in the garden, or the deep, seepy drip of warm rain. Maybe it was the chorus of spring peepers. Tad stirred, too. With the ancient toady wisdom, he knew days were getting warm and sunny up top. He knew plump, crunchy beetles and luscious, slimy slugs ambled above. Tad was half frozen to his center from the long season of sleep. Sluggishly, he scooched upward through the sand and clay and veins of rotting roots. Moisture soaked through his dry, papery skin. Near the surface, he tried a little hop, but it was lopsided and feeble, just a lurch, really, that flopped him half out of his hole. Tad opened his eyes. He lay on his side, a tasty meal for any red-tailed hawk that flew over. Using his rear diggers, he scrambled the rest of the way into the sun. The last little chunk of ice inside him melted away, and he hopped again. Stronger this time, then another hop, and another. Thank the green grass for the feisty two-spotted stink bug coming through the rye. Tad's sticky tongue snapped out, and he blinked 3 times slowly, using the back of his eyes to push the bug all the way down his gullet, enjoying it. What a fine bug it was! What a good tickle it made! A first bug always tasted the best. Tad sat in the April sun for a while, trying to catch up with himself. It had just rained, and the grass was such a sharp green that it gave him a headache. He lurched under the leaves of a feverfew plant, catching the drops of water on his warts and bumps. He put his rear end into the sun, his head under the dripping leaves of the feverfew. Tad sat as still as the clod of earth he might have been mistaken for. His belly, mottled with dark spots, fooled a night crawler dumb as dirt that wriggled out into the open and sucked. The slick dangle of luscious worm disappeared as Tad blinked three times. Ah, much better. Bundle of yummy was good in the tummy. The dew melted him into the mud, made his hands and rear diggers happy, made him awake enough and strong enough to begin hopping home. But as he made his way through the grass, something seemed to be following him. When he turned to look, there was nothing there. Yet something wasn't as it should be. His winter's sleep had been different. That was it. Tad couldn't shake off the bad feeling of the stories that had crept into his sleep. He had run from a stink-belching monster that shook the earth. He had heard strange music, too. Not toadly music, which was like the chiming of the stars. No, this music was like the wind banging things, like rain drumming the pond, ping, ping, ping. And in another scary story, he was dancing. But he was gigantic, and his rear diggers looked all wrong. And he was supposed to do something really important, but he couldn't, no matter how hard he tried. Winter sleep was the time to go back inside Mother Earth's belly and be reborn again. Mother Earth's belly was quiet and peaceful. No place for twitching, fretful toads and drumming rain. What was wrong with him?
Oh, that was great.
Oh, thank you.
I was so lulled. I just wanted you to read me the whole book. That was really delightful. I love all the rich details of, you know, the way the toad is experiencing the earth. And I'm feeling that many of those details came from you sitting and working in your own garden.
It did. But, you know, that business about toads forcing food down their gullet by blinking?
Yes.
No idea about that.
So did you do some toad research?
I did. Yeah. You know, obviously in many ways Tad is fanciful, but insofar as he's a toad, I did do research.
So what did that entail? Did you talk to experts or did you read books?
I read books.
Fun. And you must have spent some time learning about beetles as well.
Yes. You know, I did. I tried just a kind of whole host of little tiny creatures that are indigenous to Iowa. I tried to learn a bit about. But the blue topaz beetle?
Yes.
That's made up.
Oh, I didn't suspect that at all. It was so... There's a description of a beetle in this book that is very charming, and the beetle is very jewel-like, and it's an important part of some of the toad's celebrations, and it's also a very important part of how the problem in the story is resolved. But it felt completely real to me, Cheryl.
Good. I'm glad.
Place is very important in this book, and we just heard some of the point of view of one of the main characters, Tad the Toad. But in this retelling of the frog, what is it, the frog prince?
Yes.
The frog prince. There's also another main character, and that's Taylor, a young girl, and her problems kind of intertwine with Tad's problems, things they're trying to resolve. And I particularly like there were places where she talks about how important her grandmother's acreage, her grandmother's home is to her. She says it was home, the center of the universe, the place where Taylor's heart lived. Where would she go if her grandmother didn't live there? Who would she be? And there's another place where she talks about if she didn't have this particular place, you know, she couldn't do the things she was used to doing. And in our society, people move around a lot. And I'm just wanting you to talk a little bit about the importance of place.
Well, again, that's one of my very personal issues. I grew up in a place in southern Illinois, in a very quiet, isolated, special place under the loving wing of my grandmother. And all of my books, no exceptions, have important grandmothers in them. And I think all of my books, too, have a profound sense of place. Now, I have moved around a lot. The moment I left home to go to college, I knew I was never going back to that wonderful place to live. But in a very important sense, I have never left that wonderful place. So when Taylor is speaking so ardently about her desire to protect her place, that is my feeling. And I want to tell you something wonderful about my place. My grandparents' home was just down the road from my great-grandparents' home. And in fact, that whole little country road was our family. Every house on it was our family. And of course, those people have been gone forever. But as happens with so many farm homes that fall down or are destroyed or abandoned, one of my cousins has beautifully restored my grandparents' home and lives in it, and another of my cousins has beautifully restored my great-grandparents' home and lived in it. So I feel so lucky that my place is literally still there, not just in my heart.
It's really still there.
Really still there. I can go visit.
Do you have plans to do that?
Oh, I do it all the time.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
That's great. And that's in Illinois somewhere?
Yeah, southern Illinois.
And now you live in West Des Moines?
Correct.
I want to turn from the sublime thought about the connection to the earth to sort of the exact opposite, the connection to social media. I was surprised when I was reading a little bit about your, even though I've known you for many years, reading a little about your past careers, that you were at one time a manager of an IT division of a company.
Yes, I was.
I shouldn't have been surprised by that, because I knew that you were very interested in math and engineering at one time of your life.
Yes.
So how important do you think social media is for authors and the people who love authors today?
Well, I think it's very important. I think it's wonderful and important in theory, but in terms of my own life, it's still a bit of a task for me to try to maintain my presence there. I think there, I suspect that most writers are like me. We're introverts and we want to connect with people through our books, but perhaps we aren't all that social. Well, social is the first word in social media. So to actually do it, I have to discipline myself to do it. Not because I don't like people and I'm not grateful for my readers. I'm just kind of an introverted person.
In an outdoors woman.
Yeah, right.
So do you connect with your fans? Like, are you doing school visits?
I do some school visits. It's nothing I particularly try to do, but if I'm invited to do, I never say no.
You must read your books to your own grandchildren.
I do.
I do. So do they tell you things? Do you read your manuscripts before they're published ever?
No, I don't think, you know, my last two books have been kind of young adult, not appropriate for them.
For the ages where they are now.
Right. And the Over the River and the Purple Ribbon were sort of out there before they were almost. But with The Hop, they all had a great deal of interest. interest in the story as it was going on, but particularly Lizzie, who knew that she had been somewhat instrumental in the conception of the story. My grandchildren live in Texas now, and it was lots of fun to send them copies of the book shortly after it was released this spring, and to inscribe each one. And that was a real treat for me to get to do that.
I would think that they would really enjoy this book because the setting seems very like, I mean, from my imagination, very like what your garden and your yard is like.
Oh, yeah, totally. They will recognize many things.
Like maybe the mulch pile, and I don't know about the tumble-down shed. Do you have a tumble-down shed?
No, we don't have a tumble-down shed. I wish we did, but we don't. I had to make that one up. But they'll recognize the pond and the fields of flowers and the river valley.
I really liked that we get a view of this place that you create for the book based on your own garden and yard from both the toad's point of view and the girl's point of view, because they both experience this place, but they experience it in different ways. It took me a few minutes to realize the tumble-down shed and Toad and Tumble-Down. Is that the name of the village?
Almost. Toadsville by Tumbledown.
Toadsville by Tumbledown and the Tumbledown Shed are the same place. You know, that kind of didn't come together for me at first. But I guess that's part of the fun, because in the end, you realize a lot of things you don't realize in the beginning.
Right. I didn't want the reader to know too soon that Taylor and Tad had lived in the same garden the whole time.
Yeah, I hope we're not giving too much away here. In the air.
I don't think we are.
So what are you working on now?
Well, I just finished a sort of 4-year-long adult novel project that was going on while I was revising The Hop, and it's with an agent, and I'm just past midpoint on another book for young readers called The Magic Word.
Do you think there'll ever be a sequel to The Hop?
Someone asked me that the other day. Because, you know, these days, there are so many books with sequels. But I have to tell you, I can't see it. I view it as a story that is done.
Well, you get the feeling that these two main characters have a continuing connection, even though at the end, I guess I don't want to say too much about the end, but they seem like they have a lifelong connection that's very satisfying.
Well, that's true. Maybe there is a sequel there.
Can you tell us anything about The Magic Word?
I'd love to. It's like all my projects. It'll probably change a lot. It's about two sisters whose parents set off a few years ago on an ocean sailing trip and didn't come back. And during the time present of the story, the girls are in fourth and fifth grade, and the main character, Kobe, the fourth grader, believes that her parents are still living. Her dad is a magician, and her mother was a writer. And that's sort of where the magic word title comes from. But Kobe also feels in her heart that if she can find the right combination of words, the magic words, and she maintains long lists of possibly magic words, that she will be able to bring her parents back from wherever they are. Brooke, her older sister, on the other hand, has accepted that their parents are never coming back and has developed some coping mechanisms to deal with that. And it's about a few months in the lives of the girls as they work these things out.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating situation. And that's what I like about your books is they're always complex. I mean, there's always a lot going on, and as in the hop, which is what we're discussing today, there's just these, it's like you're braiding together different issues, but in a very visceral way, because these issues really matter to the characters. I'm curious about how you work on different things at the same time. So you have just finished writing this adult book, but you did that while you were revising the hop. So
yes.
Do you do it on different days, or how do you manage to do that?
No, I don't do it on different days. Once I start working with a project, you know, if I do it on different days, I have too much ramp up and ramp down time. So when I was revising the hop, you know, perhaps that took me 2 months, let's say. Well, during that 2 months, I did not work on In Late August, which is the adult project. And likewise, when I was trying to finish In Late August, you know, I was within galloping distance of home. I didn't work on anything but that. So
that kind of makes sense, because your subconscious is kind of turning on your current project, whatever it is.
Absolutely. You know, I say I write from about 6:30 to 9:30. That's true, but as you know, you think about these projects.
I want to remind listeners, you're listening to Writers' Voices. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. We're hosted by Crew 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. We're a solar-powered radio station, and we're broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Our guest today is Cheryl Byers Moranville, and we're discussing her delightful book called The Hop. It's spiritual. It has a message about fighting for what's important to you. It has environmental issues in it. It's really a great read for, I think, people of all ages. I want to turn from you as a writer to you as a teacher. And we were just talking about psychological issues, like sort of your subconscious turning over what you're working on. Do you find that when you're teaching, your subconscious starts working on what your students are working on?
Interesting question. Probably not. And actually, I'm thinking that might make me a stronger teacher for a student. You know, it's like my editors who've been so helpful to me, I can tell they have no idea the sort of subconscious me that I have put into those projects. They have no idea and probably no interest, which allows them to give better direction. So I think the distancing is helpful in an editor-writer relationship or a student-teacher relationship, perhaps. What do you think?
Oh, I'm still mulling that one over. I'll have to think about that one some more. But speaking of teaching, I would like to hear some details about when and where you're teaching here in Iowa.
Summer Writing Festival, July 17th to 23rd. A course called Five Finger Exercise for Novels and Short Stories. And so far I've heard 4 of my students, and I'm eager to hear from the rest of them, because one thing I ask my students to tell me is who are some of their favorite writers, and if I have that information, I can make up a reading packet that includes samples from some of their favorite writers.
Oh, fun. That sounds fun. And so that course is going to be in Iowa City. It's offered by the University of Iowa, Iowa Summer Writing Festival. There's a website for that organization. And people who are interested in learning more about writing for children, I think that would be a great course to take.
And Thank you.
You're welcome. And I think you're teaching a second class as well.
No.
Oh, just one this year?
Just one this year. I often do two, but we've got some family events sort of pressing on the heels of the time in Iowa City this
year. It's a wonderful opportunity for people to connect with writers at this Iowa Summer Writing Festival. And I believe, isn't that how you made a connection with Carol Gorman originally? Is that true?
It's how I cemented a connection with her. I made my first connection when I went to my first SCBWI conference, and I wanted a critique from a editor, and all those slots were filled, and I got a writer instead, thankfully. I got Carol, and she was the first word of encouragement to me. I'd been doing a lot of, like a lot of writers, I'd been writing secretly, you know, and sending things out now and then, and of course it wasn't good stuff yet, and I was building my rejection pile, and she was the first person to put her hand on my arm and say, "Oh, you're a good writer."
Oh, what a fabulous endorsement from a fabulous person.
Yes, and that's then, great. Of course, I took two classes from her in Iowa City.
So that's great. And I would like to hear a little bit about how your critique group works.
Well,
Carol, I know, is outside your critique group. She's one of your first readers.
Right.
But you have some readers who live closer to you.
Exactly. It's a wonderful critique group. And every day when I'm counting my blessings, I usually mention my critique group. We, some of us, have been together for about 10 years. The fourth person came a bit later. As I know you know, and any writer who's listening knows, good critique groups are not necessarily easy to come by. And so this one is a very good critique group. Except, you know, I don't actually call it a critique group. I'm splitting hairs here.
What do you actually
call it? My writer's group.
Your writer's group. Okay.
The reason, though, I do that is because so much of our time isn't spent critiquing. We meet monthly for lunch at Panera, and we do catch up with each other and share our joys and sorrows and so on, but basically, we do talk about our writing, essentially, the whole time. But there's so much more to being a writer, you know, than getting feedback on your text. There's fears to share and encouragement to give and advice to seek and, you know, all that. When we do have something to critique, whether it's, well, one of our writers is now Becky Yanni, is writing mainly picture books now. Well, her picture books are 3 pages long, so we critique picture books. But I gave that group a 525-page novel to critique, and they did. But our critiquing is not usually done face-to-face at our monthly gatherings. It's a written notes in the manuscript type critique when we need it. Isn't that the oddest critique group you've ever heard of?
Well, I know it's working very well because your members are turning out book after book. How many books do you think you've all... I feel like there was a count at one time of how many books your group has produced.
Yeah.
Was it 25?
Probably not quite that high. Becky is considering what's out and what's under contract. I don't know. Becky's probably 7 or 8 herself. I'm not really sure of that. Jan is 2. Eileen is 3. I'm actually 6. I did a book under a pseudonym a few years back.
What was that experience like?
You know, we have several books. We've been good for each other.
You really have been great for each other. And I know it's a social, I mean, it's a support group that extends beyond the facet of writing.
Yes, but they are all good critiquers.
Yeah. So I've come across some critiquers who, or I guess writers groups, who one of their ground rules is to never say anything that's not positive. So I'm wondering what you think about that kind of writer's group.
Well, I guess I might modify that a little, and that is always give your feedback positively. But if you're literally not going to point out opportunities you see for improvement, I think you're doing your writing colleagues a disservice.
Yeah, I'm still turning this over in my mind. I think it might have to do with what your end goal is with the writing. Because not everybody is trying to publish what they write.
Right. Yes, in that case, that's a different construct. And so, yes, I can see why. Basically, what you want to do is give the other person the sort of support they need to keep writing, which they're doing basically for enjoyment, right?
Well, it could be. I've never belonged to one of the groups that does this. I've just heard about them, and so I'm interested in exploring what that is.
Mm-hmm.
You know. How do you feel about how your education prepared you for what you're doing? I know that you had some disappointments in your education, that you were really passionate about math and science and the idea of being an engineer, and you weren't encouraged in that. So how do you feel about that today? Are you happy with where you landed?
I am happy with where I landed. I was good at math, but not truly gifted. And I can't, never look back is what I say. I'm perfectly happy with where I landed.
Do you feel that taking science classes kind of enriched your writing in a way that taking writing classes might not have?
Yes. I do think so, actually. And I think getting to know people, I dated a lot of math majors and hung out with engineers and whatnot. Just getting to know people who are, quote, like that, unquote, is enriching, because ultimately, I think maybe I wasn't like that.
Well, that's interesting, because now a lot of your friends are writers.
Yes.
And the fact that you have in your past exposure to, writers have some things that are similar about each other and being around people who are in different professions
mm-hmm.
and have different talents is probably good.
I think so, too.
So you're working on, you've completed your adult novel, it sounds like, and you're working on The Magic Word. Do you have, you've worked so successfully in so many different genres. Do you have any feeling for where you're going? Do you think you'll ever specialize in one, or do you just like trying all these different ones?
I found writing the adult novel much easier than writing for young people. Now, I've not sold the adult novel yet, so, I don't know how that's all going to turn out, but I'm just speaking from the ease of producing the manuscript. It was so much easier with the adult novel. I think people who don't write for children think writing for children is easier. But the catch is we are not children. We're adults. And to be able to get a true, authentic child's perspective and to sound like a child in narration or in dialogue, for me at least, it's wicked hard. And well, those issues aren't there with an adult novel.
Well, whatever you produce in the future, I know I'm going to be standing first in line to read it. You've been a great guest today on Writer's Voices. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. Cheryl, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Cheryl. It was a pleasure.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.